This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a roundtable discussion of the top stories in the news. Now, from CBS News headquarters in New York, here is senior correspondent Bill Lynch.
This week, we'll be looking back at the final year of the second millennium and what the events of 1999 portend for the start of the new century. We're joined by Chief Washington correspondent Bob Schieffer, 60 Minutes correspondent Andy Rooney, CBS News Sunday Morning anchor Charles Osgood, White House correspondent Mark Noller, and in our London Bureau correspondent Kimberly Dozier. We'll start with a story that preoccupied us at the beginning of the year, the impeachment trial of President Clinton, recalled by correspondent Bob Fuss.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye.
The words came from the 19th century, the last time the Senate held such a trial.
The Senate will convene as a court of impeachment.
Chief Justice William Rehnquist presided over the five-week trial. The charge was that President Clinton committed perjury and obstruction of justice in covering up his affair with Monica Lewinsky. 13 Republican men from the House of Representatives presented the case, led by Henry Hyde of Illinois.
William Jefferson Clinton, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial and removal from office.
The president's lawyers, including Gregory Craig, argued the charges were so petty a conviction would damage the nation.
No president of the United States will ever be safe from impeachment again.
The votes were mostly along party lines and fell far short of the needed two-thirds majority. The president was spared.
I want to say again to the American people how profoundly sorry I am.
The trial cast a partisan shadow over the rest of the year in Congress. Bob Fuss, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
Bob Schieffer, it appears that some Republicans, at least, wanted to continue impeachment by other means, giving the administration and the president a hard time for the rest of the year.
Well, this Congress never really got over the impeachment. It started the year with the impeachment trial, but even after the impeachment was over, it was never able to come together on anything. This was probably the least productive Congress I can remember over the last 20 years. It killed a nuclear test ban treaty that most of the world wanted, and in fact, most of the Senate actually wanted, or at least wanted to put aside a vote, but somehow they became so bollocksed up in partisanship that they wound up voting and killing it. They were unable to take any action on HMO reform. They were unable to take any action on campaign finance reform. The Republicans were unable to get any action on their main project, which was a tax cut. It was mostly a Congress that just spent the year of floundering in partisanship and got very little done.
Mark Noller, despite the president's words, there were signs that his contrition over the whole Lewinsky affair may not be as deep as he says.
Well, certainly the president went through the rest of the year trying to work on every subject and issue that he could and try and put the impeachment behind. The president made clear that he wanted to try and take a shot at legacy building during his last couple of years in office and try and make people forget about the impeachment. And to a certain extent, he did. When I go out with the president to all the events he goes to, he still gets enormous rounds of applause from people. There are very few instances of people raising the impeachment in terms of protest demonstrations. And to that extent, the president's been successful in trying to put this behind him.
Andy Rooney, there were a few people along the way who refused even to shake the president's hand after that business.
Yes, it was. It's always seemed, in relation to what Bob was saying, it's always seemed so damaging to our Republican form of government, Democratic form of government, and that the sides were so drawn along political lines. Doesn't anybody ever break that mold and say, this is damn well what I think, and I don't care what the party thinks? I just don't understand why things are so strictly done along political lines.
Charles Osgood.
Well, it seems to me that if the impeachment vote had succeeded, that the president would be Al Gore. Is that what they were trying to achieve? I think that the members of Congress, the Republicans, knew that the President Clinton was extremely popular. All the polls showed that. They knew that what they were doing was probably going to be politically damaging to them. So I would go along with the idea that this was all just this was some Republican effort to serve Republican purposes.
Well, the public may not have been paying very much attention, but Campaign 2000 began early in 1999. As Peter Mayer reports,
1999 saw one of the earliest starts to a presidential campaign. Big money and a tight 2000 primary schedule forced early announcements.
You can expect someone named George W. to win this nomination.
And on the Democratic side, Al Gore sought early momentum and distance from Bill Clinton.
I will take my own values of faith and family to the presidency.
But frontrunner status is not assured. Bill Bradley is challenging Gore, and John McCain is chasing Bush.
It is because I owe America more than she has ever owed me that I am a candidate for president of the United States.
Financial pressures quickly narrowed the field. Dan Quayle was an early GOP casualty.
I was facing a campaign where the front runner would have up to $100 million to spend.
Tight money also forced Elizabeth Dole out of the Republican race. It all sets the stage for early Iowa and New Hampshire voting just a few weeks from now. Peter Mayer, CBS News, the White House.
Well, Bob, because of unexpected competition early on in the game, both George W. Bush and Al Gore have been to some extent reinventing themselves, or at least their public persona.
Yes, I don't think anybody would have thought a year ago that you would have this close race for the Democratic nomination going on now that you have between Al Gore and Bill Bradley. This is a total surprise, I think, to most people who follow politics. Also, I think the fact that John McCain has managed to make a race out of it against really overwhelming odds because George W. Bush has raised so much money, I think is also very unexpected. But to me, the significant thing of this political year is the overpowering role that money now plays. I mean, think of it. Elizabeth Dole, John Kasich, Dan Quayle were all driven out of this race, basically for lack of money, before the first contest was held, months before the first contest was held. So this is going to be a very unusual year we're going to see coming up, because once it gets started, it's going to be over very quickly. Probably the nominees in both parties will be decided in mid-March. It used to be that, you know, when a candidate was going to run, he had his man in Fort Worth who could give him what was going on, some lawyer or preacher or somebody that was on the scene there, tell him what was going on. Now candidates don't go out into the community anymore. They hire a consultant. They hire a pollster. They hire a grooming consultant, speech coaches. This enormous numbers of the entourage that has increased so is part of where the money is going.
Andy, in addition to money, the buzzword has been authenticity this year. Both McCain and Bradley seeming to benefit from that.
I do think they ring truer than some of them. That statement we just heard from Al Gore didn't ring very true to me. It sounded like something he had been advised to say. I think a bell ought to go off every time one of the candidates reads something that someone else wrote.
Next up, the tragedy at Columbine.
You're listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Last April, an ordinary day at high school in Littleton, Colorado, turned into a bloody nightmare. Correspondent David Dow covered the Columbine killings.
It was a call police never expected in the tidy Denver suburb. A bloodbath at Columbine High School.
The best way to describe it was a war zone.
Two teenagers, members of the so-called trench coat mafia, roamed the school hallways, hurling bombs and blazing away with a small arsenal.
Everyone around me got shot, and I begged him for 10 minutes not to shoot me.
They attacked the crowded cafeteria, then headed for the library.
You could hear them laughing and running upstairs, and they were shooting.
Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold killed 12 of their schoolmates, a teacher, and then themselves. They wounded more than two dozen others. Even as the victims were being mourned, bomb scares and would-be copycats surfaced in other American schools. And there would be more school violence in such places as Conyers, Georgia, and Fort Gibson, Oklahoma. David Dow, CBS News.
Bob, you mentioned that in the Doolittle Congress, even gun legislation proposed after Littleton, Colorado, apparently went nowhere. But the administration late in the year did decide to join some lawsuits against gun manufacturers.
Well, we'll see where all of that goes, but the pressure on the Congress on this issue is the most, most intense of any issue. It's almost like my mother used to be about Social Security. You didn't have to criticize Social Security. You just mentioned the word Social Security, and she was convinced people were going to take it away from her. It's the same way with people when you come to talk about guns. You just mention guns, and the people who have guns are automatically convinced that somebody's going to try to take them away.
Now, the media spent much of the year focused on Columbine and similar shootings, and largely ignored the fact that overall schools are, in fact, safer than they've been year after year. Is this an irresponsible way of covering stories like this?
Well, I don't know, because anytime you have these guns, even though schools are safer, anytime guns are introduced into this mix, then you have these horrible things. I mean, we had a deranged person who walked into the U.S. Capitol and shot two Capitol policemen. Had that man been armed with a baseball bat, those policemen would be alive. These people that went into Columbine, had they been armed with axes even, many of those students would still be alive. But we're still grappling with this business of how do we put these guns out of reach of deranged people. It's almost like I compare it to if you have a two-year-old in the house, you don't get rid of the paint thinner, you don't get rid of the rat poison, the things you need in a household, but you put them on a higher shelf. We have yet to find a way in this country to put these guns on a higher shelf, and that's what we're going to have to do.
Charlie Osgood, there's a widespread belief that the trend toward violence and whatnot in the media is at least partly responsible for some of these kids going around the bend.
Well, I think statistically there's been less violence, not only in the schools, but elsewhere in society, and there are a lot of reasons for that. Some having to do with the fact that more people are employed now, and maybe there's a little less desperation in the air. But I have to wonder about a situation like that. Yes, you have a couple of deranged kids, but it's amazing that somebody that sick would not have been noticed before, that even their own parents would not have known that something terrible was going on, even before the first shot was fired.
Kimberly Dozier in London, we talk about the political reaction or lack of it to the Columbine shootings, but in Great Britain, the reaction to the shootings in Dunblane, Scotland, was almost immediate and resulted in sweeping changes in gun laws.
Very extreme. You have stringent checks to go through now, and even to they're taking Olympic rifle competitors can now not practice in this country. They say they're having to travel to other countries to compete. And that's how people want it here. Then again, you've got bobbies walking the beat armed with clubs and pepper spray. And I was talking to a couple of guys who said that they'd had the pepper spray for 3 months and just used it for the first time against a guy armed with a knife. And I said, you know, how would you feel walking the streets in New York? And they said, hey, that would be like being at war.
Well, absolutely. The role of obituaries for 1999 is a long one. Kings Hussein of Jordan and Hassan of Morocco were both succeeded by popular sons. Sam Litzinger has more, including the loss of an American icon.
Folks recalled where they were when they heard the news his father had died. Now they remember where they were when the news came about John F. Kennedy Jr., his wife Carolyn, and her sister Lauren.
An aircraft that departed from Fairfield, New Jersey, en route to Martha's Vineyard, and then to Hyannis, has been reported overdue.
All three were killed when their small plane crashed into the Atlantic. The final chapter for Catch-22 author Joseph Heller. The final coda for music makers Charles Brown, Hoyt Axton, and Mel Torme.
I got rhythm. I got music.
The sports world lost a lot of greats in 1999. Joe DiMaggio being one of the greatest. Also gone, Wilt Chamberlain, Pee Wee Reese, Walter Payton, Payne Stewart, and Jim Catfish Hunter. The man who's best known, George C. Scott, took his final bow, as did Victor Mature, Madeline Kahn, and DeForest Kelly, Star Trek's Dr. McCoy, and Clayton Moore, the Lone Ranger. And the man who reviewed a lot of their work is gone. Critic Gene Siskel died. Thumbs up for lives well lived. Sam Litzinger, CBS News.
I knew some of those people, and I think the mention of Joe DiMaggio always evokes in me one of the great kudos I ever heard paid to a sports figure. Somebody said Joe DiMaggio never made a tough catch in his life. I thought that was a great... I mean, he was so graceful doing it.
And on
didn't look hard.
Capitol Hill, John Chafee passed away this past year.
And that will be a real loss in the Senate. He was one of the last of the senators who could actually reach across party lines and get support for programs. They'll miss John Chafee in Washington.
And early in the new year, we already know there's a casualty. Charlie Brown and Snoopy and the rest of the Peanuts gang will apparently disappear because Charles Schulz, after becoming ill in 1999, has decided to retire.
You know who we miss at a time like that? These people don't get to have Charles Carroll talk about it. He always did that very graceful obituary piece he did every year.
On Sunday morning. We still do it.
I know that. Andy. I know.
Not as graceful as it used to be, though.
Yeah, I put my foot in it there, didn't I?
You can be forgiven. Well, anyway, next up, Mother Nature gives us a cruel year. In terms of natural disasters, 1999 was a costly year. Earthquakes killed some 18,000 people in Turkey alone and thousands more in Taiwan, Colombia, and Greece. A cyclone killed 10,000 and left 2.5 million homeless in India, while flooding and mudslides killed as many as 50,000 people recently in Venezuela. In this country, Hurricane Floyd devastated large parts of the eastern seaboard, as Christopher Glenn recalls.
It wasn't the wind, it was the rain. Hurricane Floyd slammed across the Bahamas, skirted the coast of Florida, and blasted ashore at Wilmington, North Carolina with so much rain, some towns were underwater for more than a week.
Everything I got is gone. It's just gone.
Rescuers couldn't work fast enough. North Carolina Governor James Hunt was frustrated.
We wish we had a whole lot more stuff here and everywhere else. But folks, we got some folks still in danger of dying right now as we're sitting here.
It was the worst flooding ever to hit North Carolina.
I'm 71 years old and I ain't never seen it like this.
Floyd quickly moved up the coast where New Jersey Governor Christy Whitman saw more flooded homes.
It's devastating. There are people who have lost their homes, their clothes, everything.
By the time Floyd dissipated off New England and moved out to sea, counties from Florida to New York had been declared disaster areas. Christopher Glenn, CBS News.
And there were disasters elsewhere in a variety of forms. The Egypt Air crash off the Massachusetts coast killed 217 people and remains a mystery. All the evidence points to the co-pilot of that plane deliberately nosing it down into the Atlantic Ocean. And the investigation is complicated somewhat by sensitivities of the Egyptian government. Do you think we'll ever know what happened, gentlemen, to that?
Black boxes are a disappointment, aren't they? I mean, they say it'll be days before we know, and first thing you know, it's 3 weeks later, and we still don't know. I mean...
But in this case, the black boxes were recovered and showed no mechanical problems.
You know, I think that there's one aspect that this points up, and that is our tendency now, because we're trying to cover the news before it happens or before we have information, we're on the air with an awful lot of speculation about what ordinarily happens, what's going to happen, how many days is it going to take, what are the possible scenarios that we have in a given situation. And I think we put an awful lot of baloney out on the air in the name of news in these situations where we don't really know.
Well, that's just kind of the downside of the information age, where we get so much information so quickly. There's a tendency, I think, to expect answers as quickly as we get the information. And, of course, that's not going to happen. I'm not sure we'll ever know in the case of
the thing
crash.
That made me doubt this one who was the chief suspect was responsible for it was the story that he bought
some tires.
Went to two Costco places to get cheap tires to bring home for his old car, and called his son in advance to meet him at the airport so that he could get him in the car and take him home. I don't think that's something someone does if he's about to bring down a plane with himself in it.
Kimberly Dozier, the year ended with a post-Christmas disaster weather-wise on the continent. How has the various countries responded to that?
Well, the snow has hit hard. The harsh weather has hit, and France is still recovering from a really tough hurricane. They've called out the army to get people back on their feet and get the power back on, get some roofs back up. It's been an unexpected end to a very tough year, but it's also brought home to a lot of people in Europe what they think of as normally someone else's problem. They've been hearing about earthquakes in Turkey and Taiwan and faraway places, the war in Kosovo, and all of a sudden Mother Nature can just bring you up short and show you that everybody's equal.
Of course, we were preoccupied for much of the year with the impending Y2K changeover of the calendar. Kimberly, in the days leading up to the new year, some bank machines started to fail in your area.
Yes, people going to the cash machines found about 20,000 machines did not work. Suddenly, the machines ticked over into the year 2000. It was looking 4 days ahead at the time, and it didn't compute. So what happened was the bank had to tell people, well, hold off for 4 or 5 days. And the government had to tell people, well, this is what we warned you about. Please try to keep some extra cash at home. For those who didn't think ahead about that, they're kind of stuck.
All of this, gentlemen, strikes me as another evidence that sometimes we are victims as much as beneficiaries of all the technology that we've been blessed with.
I had a great thing happen to me yesterday. I didn't realize it. I may have been the last one. I have an old computer. It can't fix it, set it to 2000. So somebody told me that 1972 has the same days of the week and the same dates as 2000, so I'm setting my old computer to
72.
Has anybody else made preparations or gotten water and food stocked in?
Well, I was interested in what you said, Bill, when you said we all think that there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of, but yet I have a sense that everybody's scared to death. I mean, nobody really knows. It's almost sort of medieval. I mean, the attitude here, we're all afraid of the evil eye or some curse that's about to happen. Nobody quite knows. It's just extraordinary to me, the attitudes that we see.
Does it bother anybody but me that we're seeing the first 99-year century in history?
No, it doesn't. I know it's popular for people to be bothered by it, but it doesn't bother me at all. I think the year 2000, just by the name of it itself, is reason enough to call it that.
Well, I think it was Pope Gregory the VIII, if I remember, who was the one who sort of decreed that how the dates were going to be, and it's been sort of set in stone since then. But this time it was not a pope, it was not a king, it was not the United Nations, it was us. It was the media that decided that, by golly, this century was going to begin because this is the digital age. We just love all those zeros hanging out there.
Mark Nolder, did the government, the Bureau of Standards, for example, have anything to do with that?
Well, actually, the U.S. Naval Observatory is quite upset with the idea that people mistakenly believe that the year 2000 is the first year of the new century and the first year of the third millennium. And I wanted, and I think they'd be very glad with you, Bill, in introducing this program. You said that we were about to enter the final year of the 21st century and the second millennium.
But when a baby is 6 months old, you don't call him 1 year old, and that's what we did with when we started naming the years. We started when the first year was 6 months old, we called it one.
Well, the concept of a zero didn't come along until much later. Mark Nolder, I was struck. I was reading a newspaper article quoting an official from the Naval Observatory, and he had the wonderful title of being the director of the Directorate of Time.
That is a great title.
Washington is full of them, but that's certainly better than being the deputy assistant to the Assistant Secretary of State for Oceanic Affairs.
I wonder what the director of the Directorate of Time does all day.
Well, I don't know. One of the things, you know,
time.
The government has Washington just inaugurated a new atomic clock, which will be the most accurate clock in the history of time. It will not lose a single second for the next 20 million years. So perhaps he'll be
for what
of
purpose,
checking that
one
clock.
Wonders. To keep broadcasts like this on time, perhaps. At any rate, when we come back, we'll take a look at air power bringing a dictator to heel.
You're listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Last spring, NATO launched a 78-day bombing campaign to force a Serb withdrawal from Kosovo and an end to ethnic killing and the uprooting of some 850,000 refugees. Kimberly Dozier prepared a look back.
At first, it seemed that rare thing, a war of good against evil. NATO airstrikes to halt Yugoslavia's dirty war against its independence-minded Kosovars. Almost a million were expelled. Yugoslavia blamed it on NATO bombs. Kosovar refugees said otherwise.
I stay in the basement 3 days and wait for somebody to kill us.
Belgrade captured, then released, three American soldiers.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
NATO bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, calling it a mistake. But insiders claim it was to stop Yugoslav forces transmitting there. Belgrade capitulated after 78 days. NATO entered Kosovo, swiftly followed by the refugees. But the horrors the refugees found, burned villages, dead loved ones, turned their grief to vengeance, driving out the Serbs. Neither the UN nor NATO has managed to keep the peace, and evil seems to be winning on all sides. Kimberly Dozier, CBS News.
Mark Nolder, in the weeks after the Serbs folded their tents and went left Kosovo, we began to learn that NATO came a lot closer to launching a ground campaign than had been generally believed at the time.
Well, it was week after week after week that the air campaign was going on without the desired results of ending the Serb assaults or driving all the Serbs out of Kosovo, and they were considering all the contingencies. The White House says that, and the President says he never ruled it out, although he said it was not something that he wanted to do, but the military people were worried about whether or not the air campaign would succeed, and so, yes, in fact, they actually were considering that as an option.
And Kimberly, in your report, you talk about the NATO peacekeepers who were there, but the American contingent, some 20,000, I believe, is going to be there quite a while.
Yes, they're going to be, they say it's an open-ended stay. That's how they're describing it. And now Camp Bondsteel, where they're based, has turned into a small city. That's in the center of Kosovo. They are frequently under fire. They are frequently trying to break up fights between Serbs and Kosovar Albanians. It's a very tough mission, and it doesn't look like they've done much more than, well, kind of kept the two sides apart by the scruff of the neck, but they haven't stopped the war.
Charlie?
Yeah, but I think one of the questions that was raised at the time when we intervened was whether were we taking sides in a civil war, and we said that we were not, certainly not our intention to do that. And yet it seems that now whatever ethnic cleansing is going on is going on in the opposite direction, and the people who are running the Kosovo Liberation Army seem to be the ones who have more power than anybody else. And so it's as if we did intervene on behalf of them.
Bob Schieffer, is the Congress going to be able to sustain support for the American units there?
Well, there's never been very much support for this from the very beginning. This was a year going back to the partisanship that we saw that has engulfed this Congress throughout the year after the impeachment. Partisanship really did not stop at the water's edge on this one. Republican leaders were very much against this in the beginning. I would guess that there will be a lot of questions raised about this, especially in an election year, which we're going to have. So I think we'll hear a lot more of it. I don't really know how that would come out, but there's never been much support for this in the Congress.
But there are those who made the case that if NATO had not pursued this campaign, NATO itself would have been a great peril.
Oh, I think that's right. And I think NATO would have come apart had the United States not taken part in this operation. Results beside the point.
One other piece of fallout from all of this, of course, Mark Noller, is a further straining of the relations with Russia, which stolidly opposed the NATO operation in Kosovo. Any sign as we begin the new year that that's improving?
Well, Bill, with the unexpected resignation of Boris Yeltsin on New Year's Eve in Moscow, it certainly changes the nature and dynamic of the U.S.-Russian relationship. Yeltsin was not the easiest of leaders to work with. Most recently, Yeltsin rejected appeals from the U.S. and its Western allies to end the Russian onslaught on Chechnya and seek a negotiated settlement. Nevertheless, in commenting on Yeltsin's resignation, President Clinton accentuated the positive.
His lasting achievement has been dismantling the communist system and creating a vital democratic process within a constitutional framework.
Now, American officials have long known that Yeltsin's health was so frail that he often was not up to the task of president, though they did not say so publicly. Now the U.S. must work with acting President Vladimir Putin, who stands a good chance of succeeding Yeltsin permanently in special elections in 3 months. Mr. Clinton says he looks forward to working with Putin. He has already met with him a couple of times at international gatherings at which Putin filled in for the ailing Yeltsin. Putin is certainly younger and in much better health than Yeltsin, but he shares Yeltsin's strong-arm policy on Chechnya, which is a politically popular position in Russia.
Well, gentlemen and Kimberly, there is at least a couple of bright spots as we look toward the new millennium, one of them being the great progress that seems to have been made in easing the hundreds-year-old conflict in Northern Ireland. With now you have a joint power-sharing government running things pretty much there. Kimberly, is the outlook for continued improvement?
It actually feels like this is going to work, and you get that feeling north and south of the border in Ireland, Ireland and Northern Ireland. There are signs that in the new year, if the IRA doesn't disarm in time, that there could be problems. But now people are looking at it as sort of bumps in the road, not roadblocks. There's such momentum pushing things forward, and such momentum by the people themselves, that there's a feeling that they won't tolerate any more squabbling among their leaders.
And at year's end, we also can look forward to some progress in the new year in talks, new talks, between Israel and Syria that may very well result in an agreement for Israel to withdraw from the Golan Heights in exchange for new security guarantees, perhaps enforced by a U.S. monitoring presence. But at least Israel would have begun to make peace, or had made peace, with all of its Arab neighbors.
I think these talks are the most serious step toward peace that we've seen, certainly in the last two or three years. Nobody thinks this is going to be easy. Nobody thinks this is going to be accomplished overnight. But the fact that Syria and Israel have begun to talk, Israel is actually talking about giving back land in exchange for some agreement to peace, that's pretty remarkable. Whether the the Israeli prime minister can now sell this to his own people is another question, of course. But I think the feeling in Washington with most people you talk about is that this is a significant development.
I was reading a book about Albert Einstein in relation to his being chosen as man of the century, and I was interested in a comment he wrote that hatred and violence comes naturally to mankind, and that under normal circumstances it is submerged. It does not come out, but it comes up. It is very easy to evoke it. And when people get violent, one thing leads to another. And I think that it is possible, and I think we're seeing some of this in Ireland and in Israel. It is being temporarily suppressed, this hatred and violence, and possibly we could just go along on a level plane if we could keep it.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so. Next up, the U.S. economy keeps breaking records. Despite those Y2K jitters, the U.S. economy again led the world in 1999. As correspondent Dan Revive reports, the recovery is about to become the longest ever.
The economy is something to crow about for President Clinton.
We've got the strongest economy in history. We've cut our welfare rolls in half. We've got the lowest crime rate in 30 years.
Inflation is low, less than 3%, and so is unemployment, a 30-year low, 4.1%, defying conventional economics. To attract workers, employers should find they have to raise wages, and that should lead to rising prices. But inflation is the number one enemy for the Fed, led by Alan Greenspan.
The Federal Reserve has strong...
All year, he warned that if prices rise, our prosperity could fade. A lot of it is the instant money made on the stock market. That's the sound of the New York Exchange, up around 20% this year. High-tech gains even higher in all those dot-com companies.
BarnesandNoble.com already has a great...
Priceline.com and name your own price.
Searching the web for auto, life, or health insurance.
An estimated 20 million Americans shopped online this holiday season, including 7 million first-time e-shoppers. A flurry of spending to round out a prosperous year. Dan Revive, CBS News, Washington.
Mark Noller, is there anyone on the president's economic team who is worried about the bubble bursting in the year 2000?
No. What's on their mind right now is the fact that come February, this administration is ready to celebrate the longest ever continuous expansion of the U.S. economy in history. And if you think the New Year's celebration is big, wait till that. They just can't wait.
And Alan Greenspan's future job prospects, given all that?
Well, the president has said publicly how much he appreciates what Alan Greenspan has done, and it's hard to imagine he wouldn't ask Greenspan to serve again, but it's not sure that Greenspan wants to continue serving.
Charlie Osgood, do you expect things to keep rolling like this?
Now, why would anybody pay any attention to what I thought about this? I don't know. But I must say, it does bother me a little bit that we have Mr. Bezos as the man of the year for time, and he has never made a nickel. His company, I think this year, is supposed to lose $335 million. And I know that there's lots of rationalization for that, but you wonder, how long can that go on?
Imagine he still eats good, though, doesn't he?
I think so, because he's made a lot of money on the stock. But maybe that's what it's all about, is people are buying the stock not because they think that someday this company is going to make money. They're buying the stock because they think that maybe next month and next year it'll be worth a lot more than it is today. It's not It's not what the company does. It's that there is this thing, and it reminds me of the tulip craze. You know, they had many centuries ago, where it's not the intrinsic value of the thing, but the fact that somebody is willing to pay for it. You know, you wait for the bigger fool to come along and pay more for it. And I'm not saying that that's true about that company, but it does make you wonder. And that's one of the most successful ones. That's why the man is on the cover of Time.
It's the best bet in the casino. It's not necessarily that the company is the best company, but you're betting that this stock is going up. Well, the odds are that you're betting that the odds are that it will.
And that has a sort of pyramid scheme aspect to it, because that can't go on forever.
The Achilles heel of e-commerce revealed itself over the holidays when many of these companies failed to deliver on time the gifts that were supposed to be there for Christmas under the tree.
I bet the department stores hated those stories about how bad the email was at returning.
Absolutely. Well, as we come to the end of this broadcast, marking the end of one era and the beginning of another, let's talk about where we are as a country, as a society. Bob Schieffer, looking back, how do you think America is different than it was 30, 40 years ago?
Well, I think this was a great century, perhaps the greatest century ever. I agree with those who say this was the American century. When you travel in Europe, when you travel in Asia, you see how dominant the American economy is. Everybody speaks English now. I can remember a time when the international language was French, but that's no longer so. The one thing that worries me about America right now is it seems to me we're becoming a ruder society. It seems to me we're meaner to each other, whether it's in our politics, which are dirty and nasty. It's no longer enough to win. You have to destroy your opponent. Or whether you're just out driving your car and you experience this road rage where nowadays nobody gives an inch, everyone must have the last word. If I were to say the one thing that worries me as we go into the future, it would be that aspect of American society.
Andy?
Well, I wonder if, do you think there's a diminution in the cultural level of the society as a whole? I think we have become a coarser society, and especially in the last several years. In regard to your statement about English, I am convinced that English is creeping around the world as everyone's second language for one very simple reason. It's a better language than anyone else's. It's not a perfect language, but it is not as pretty as French, but it's a more useful language, and it's something like four times as big, because we have accepted new nuances of meaning to words that the French have ruled out. They won't take in any new words officially.
And talk about being coarser. It seems to me some of the words that are used now in everyday discourse are words that I would have had my mouth washed out with soap when I was a kid.
Kimberly Dozier, can we look forward to a continuation of a United States of Europe in the new century?
Absolutely. It does seem to be going in that direction with a few hiccups along the way. People are getting more used to thinking of each other as Europeans, especially when they have something like they can look at a Kosovo and say, well, not perfect, but we did that together. And we don't have the shame of it's erasing the shame of Bosnia. And now they're even stepping forward and talking about a combined European defense initiative where this place is beginning to act as one unit. It's coming.
To what extent do you think that's a rejection of American hegemony to some extent?
Many people, as I travel anywhere in the world, they talk about, you know, they love Americans, but they just wish we wouldn't spend so much time telling the rest of the world what to do. While Americans often think that they're just doing the right thing, it's the way the message is delivered that at times, you know, it gets people's back up, and that's never a good idea.
Mark Noller, President Clinton is going to finish out the remainder of his term, or most of it, in this coming year. He's also going to be watching his wife run for the U.S. Senate and making plans for his post-presidency. Any predictions?
I think what you're going to see in this final year of the Clinton presidency is Mr. Clinton taking his last shot at legacy building, looking to achieve as much as he can, looking to try and put that impeachment as far behind as possible. What will be interesting to see will be the degree to which both Al Gore and the First Lady ask for the president's political help in campaigning in their own campaigns for vice president in the Senate.
Okay, Mark Noller, thank you very much. And that's the only prediction I asked for on this broadcast. And hopefully nobody will have to live down any predictions that were made. Our thanks to Mark Noller, also to Bob Schieffer, Andy Rooney, Charles Osgood, and in London, Kimberly Dozier. Please join us next week for another edition of the Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News.